This is called Some Ship Thing Who Sang, Even Human Voices, In the Foreground, Space and a Lake. Something Even Human Voices, In the Foreground, a Lake, by Kathleen Frazier, and The Ship Who Sang, by Anne McCaffrey, are as different from each other visually as they are in content. To look at them is to witness the polarity between high and popular culture, small press, Kelsey Street, and big press, Ballantine Publishing. They have been written, and the covers, typeface, and paper have been chosen for consumption by these two different markets. As cultural artifacts, each book physically represents and embodies in its writing a different political aesthetics of form. Something Even Human Voices was written from within a tradition of British and US 20th century modernist, mainly white and often bisexual or lesbian women writers. Some of these include Stein, Richardson, Barnes, H.D., Mina Loy, and Dickinson. This is a tradition that has been invisible to and erased by dominant male academic canonic and publishing practices and by many male poets. The Ship Who Sang was originally a short story, and Anne McCaffrey was originally a writer of Gothic romances. It was written from within the mainly British genre of speculative fiction. McCaffrey describes herself as 99% Irish. She studied voice production for 9 years before arriving at the, quote, horrifying conclusion that she was a better stage director of opera than a singer. Issues surrounding questions of form and embodiment are raised visually on both books' covers. Both covers have pictures of women on them, and on both, it is hard to determine the women's contexts or shapes. Both women appear to be in some way disembodied. The woman on Fraser's cover is an abstract drawing of a woman that probably has a cohesive body, but it is unclear just how she fits together. What position is she in? Is that the landscape or one of her legs? Are questions that come to mind as I look at the cover. The woman on McCaffrey's cover has only a head, which hovers over some sort of planetscape. Where is the rest of her? Is the question which immediately rises off of this cover. Both of these images refer to one of the issues central, thank you, to each book, issues of boundary. I will focus here on issues of boundary and the ways in which boundaries are constructed, negotiated, and played with by McCaffrey and Fraser's uses of form and voice. I'm using voice to mean the power to represent one's ravings, one's thoughts, one's desires in public words, spoken or written. The public could be oneself when one says to oneself what has been unsayable. It could be a large anonymous audience, seen or invisible, or one other intimate person, alive or dead. And saying can be something that happens out loud as speech, out loud as writing that echoes in writers' and readers' ears, or something that happens silently in an inside rain of word confetti. The form and therefore the order of a book, a body, a poem, or a spoken, written, or sung voice determines the way in which that form will position other bodies, poems, or voices in relation to itself. Thus, the aesthetic organization of a voice or voices also presents a political order. To summarize what is inside of both books, The Ship Who Sang is an episodic story of Helva, born as a thing with twisted limbs and an alert mind. This is a quote from the back cover. She is transferred into a metal shell and trained to be hooked up to and operate an intergalactic scout ship. The book describes her romantic, heterosexual escapades and relationships with those who live within her. It is as if Helva is pregnant with relationship. Much of the third-person narrative relates Helva's thoughts about humans and other beings and ships she encounters. Helva's unusual ability to sing and to make judgments independently of central worlds, the government organization for whom she works and who is responsible for her education and conversion into intergalactic spaceship form, marks her as unique and desirable among ships. Something is a collection of pieces of writing loosely in paragraph form. The titles to these pieces are phrases, whole sentences, or notes. The pieces are narrative, but don't tell stories with beginnings, middles, and ends, and the pieces have something to do with one another, or with many things, but are not a linearly developed sequence of thought or image, though both do develop. Within the book, there are more abstract drawings of women, all variations of the cover drawing. The women are sitting but not static. In fact, the unclosed lines that are the edges of their bodies lend them the look of being in motion. And the same can be said of the open form of these written pieces that look and feel to exist in the midst of a gesture and thought. Common expectations about what constitutes a story are displaced first by the title, the drawings, the table of contents, which can be read as a piece by itself, and finally, by the cerebral and physical synesthesia of Fraser's language. Both feminist experimental poetic practices and those of some feminist science fiction pivot on what Rachel Blau Du Plessis, referring to feminist science fiction, has called a poetics of estrangement. Feminist experimental poetic practices consist in playing with and rupturing conventional poetic and narrative structures. Feminist science fictive practices consist in telling stories that disrupt ideological structures by altering traditional patterns of imagining. Some of these feminist science fiction writers are also poets, and many feminist experimental poets are concerned with imagining and constructing alternative worlds through linguistic estrangement. Though there are some parallel intents and common issues, it remains more than a blurring of generic boundaries to speak of McCaffrey's and Fraser's books in the same breath. McCaffrey does not write out of a feminist or experimental agenda, as do Fraser and many writers of feminist science fiction. Reading and writing are occasions for resistance or merging, and genre boundaries describe the kinds of resistance and merging that different kinds of writing present and require. Again, Delaney. As Delaney says in his essay, Generic Protocols, a genre, to the extent that it can be said to exist as a genre, is constituted of a way of reading, what we may henceforth call a protocol of reading, a structuration of response potential. I have attempted here to use my own boundary problems to read aspects of something as science fiction and aspects of The Ship Who Sang as poetry, to see where the books might yield to or suggest each other. Where is the rest of her? What position is she in? Or how do Helva, Fraser, and McCaffrey define themselves through use of voice, or in Fraser's case, voices? One of the things that something, even human voices, is about is the struggle for Fraser to find her voices and simultaneously the subjects of her writing outside of the dominant male univocal model. The poem, Medusa's hair was snakes, was thought split inward, illustrates the struggle well. It is an almost unrecognizable reformation of the Medusa story. It has everything to do, though, with the danger of being beheaded by either a certain kind of logical thinking embodied by a man or by one's own inability to give one's experiences voices, as opposed to one essential true voice and shape. Quote, I do not wish to report on Medusa directly, this variation of her writhing. After she gave that voice a shape, it was the trajectory itself in which she found her words floundering and pulling apart. Most of these quotes that I give you, some people have anyway in those handouts. Finding voices for Fraser means writhing out of the socialization which has conditioned a way of thinking about language largely based on resisting boundary loss. The task of finding voice outside of the canonized models also presents a boundary problem. Fraser presents this variation in writing of Medusa's writhing as a formal vocal trajectory. Medusa's beheaded body and the open body of this poem pose questions such as, when does a language practice constitute a legitimate body, i.e. a poem, and when is it deformed? This is parallel to the question with which The Ship Who Sang opens. Quote, she was born a thing, and as such would be condemned if she failed to pass the encephalograph test required of all newborn babies. There was always the possibility that though the limbs were twisted, the mind was not, that though the ears would hear only dimly, the eyes see vaguely, the mind behind them was receptive and alert. Helva was born a thing, and after passing a test was called, quote, human, which meant potentially acceptable, since she did not manifest the standard form. Her later embodiment as an intergalactic spaceship poses the question, when is a human a machine and not a human? To return to Fraser and some parallel questions, when is a poem a confessional journal entry, a fragment of overheard conversation, and not a poem? When is a woman writer outside of the patriarchal encephalograph test, which grants a piece of writing the genre title poem or the unacceptable name of deformed thing? In the piece called Later and Tense, Looking Too Big for the Body, Fraser speaks in what she calls this second language, a language that transgresses generic protocols. Later and Tense, Looking Too Big for the Body. Something has leaked out. I could have gone away, dropping precipitously into the other life, uniformly spaced drinks and a heavy leaf supporting this September air. Oh, receive us, houses with terraces. Open 9 light bulbs and let the doors have crossed locks. This second language accommodates more bathing. You offer cheese, which you have divided to keep us hungry for a later precise event. She speaks here of a feeling held by the concrete detail of this moment, flooded and made ultra visible by the opening light of 9 light bulbs. The moment invites her to drop into it, and she descends, then divides herself from it in shifting from I to you. She speaks to a house and says of this second language that it accommodates more bathing, a description of what the language itself is doing, that is, bathing in and receiving the converging sense and thought of this moment. Fraser moves liquidly here and elsewhere between first, second, and third person narratives, from speech to observation, from emotion to self-conscious reflection. The Ship Who Sang is about Helva's discoveries of the powers and uses of her voice. Helva was not conditioned to learn the myriad powerful uses of her voice as she was conditioned to learn almost everything else. It is an ability she discovers independently of central worlds, the patriarchy. Helva uses her voice and her ability to judge well outside of the rules of central worlds as her means to heroic action. Due to lack of time, I can only give one much shortened example of Helva's literal and figurative heroic action. And here it is. In one episode, Helva has a theater troupe on board, whose members are required to change form in order to, quote, transmit their performance of Romeo and Juliet on the planet of Corviki. The troupe is short one person, and because of Helva's knowledge of Shakespeare, her perfect recall, and excellent voice, she becomes part of the performance. In order to perform on Corviki, the troupe members must transfer from bodies into energy emanations, and Helva must leave her titanium shell for the first time. The performance is experienced by the Corvikians as varying levels of energy emanation based mainly on the actors and actresses' voice, tone, and volume. Helva's presence at their first performance saves the entire troupe from staying dangerously longer than the allotted 7 hours. The rest of the troupe goes into a stupor, and Helva arouses them with her projecting voice. It turns out to be highly pleasurable to be embodied in an emanation of sensual energy. The desire to yield to the seduction of becoming permanently Corvikian is expressed in Helva's and the troupe's subtle change of language use. As they become more and more desirous of Corvikian embodiment, they become simultaneously more and more like Corvikians in their speech. The experience and speech of being Corvikian is characterized from Helva's point of view in this way. She could see every part of her ship cell from one scanner or another. How limiting mobility was. Well, she'd looked around as far as she was able and stared down in an unlimited perspective until finally her sight distinguished a burbling, burping mass of ochre eruptions that she recognized as ground. Above and around her, fronds swayed, exhaled and inhaled in a full spectrum of colors, unbelievably varied and varying, color which in some cases had sound and smell as part of their value. What is seductive and most marked in this passage is the confusion of boundaries illustrated by the confusion of names for things. McCaffrey's narrative voice serves as trajectory and protective distance, as does Helva's titanium shell. On Corviki, traditional definitions in language break down when colors have sound and smell, and when what is normally called ground, because it is stable, is now a burbling, burping mass of ochre eruptions. The words used to articulate experience, such as sound, or smell are no longer accurate. New language, new use of voice is required of humans on Corviki, along with the experience of new embodiment. This comes dangerously close to no longer qualifying as play acting and becoming instead actual transformation. Though the roles of things, people, and words are no longer distinguishable from one another as static identities, McCaffrey's narrative remains grammatically ordered and untouched by this disarray. On Corviki, without her shell, Helva's form and linguistic forms of representation blur. On Corviki, one's embodiment becomes one's voice. The way one moves is the way one speaks. Corvikian communication is dangerous because the static, underlying system of grammar, like a skeleton in a body, is unrecognizably transferred. These Corvikian characteristics define the dangerous limits of outer space in The Ship Who Sang. They are the edges that Helva is able to explore largely because of her unusual use of her voice. And they are the limits of interior space that Frazier enters, explores, and inhabits with her voices. At the edges of unexplored space, interior or exterior, language is transformed into energy and is not recognizable as it has previously been. These boundary explorations are manifest by both writers' uses of narrative structure. To briefly summarize here, Frazier uses her language to both construct herself and her experience, and to structure it outside of the inscribed expectations of dominant storytelling practices. Here is an example of her multi-layered structuring of herself and her poem form. This is an excerpt from a poem. She is unfinished. She is structurally out of breath. When she comes close to something achieved, she enters a low and constant warning buzz. On Sunday, in the middle of her exercises, she begins to cry quite unexpectedly. The fourth corner loose, unanchored, unattended, she can't seem to stop. The form of the poem, of Frazier, of the bodies drawn in the middle of the book, are unfinished, unanchored, and can't seem to stop. Like the snakes on Medusa's head, the book ends and cannot be cut off. The reader dips in, flounders, is pulled apart. If she swims, she enters the lake that is this body of writing. If she approaches with only an analytic dividing blade, there will be no opening, only drowning in or drowning out, as Helva does, projecting her singing voice, a beam of the light of Western culture and technology through space. Helva enters the chaotic Corvikian realm of poetry through the voice of the only poet, Shakespeare. As brainship, Helva is the inverse of Medusa, only head, beheaded in order to be enshrined in titanium by central worlds. She sings for central worlds, an operatic, phallic mother machine, flying through the univocal universe of Zeus's brain space. There is only one public spectacle in which Helva can act, the romance of Romeo and Juliet. The reader watches the spectacle of Helva's performance as silent audience. Invisible in the wings, McCaffrey, like the male officers of central worlds, moves Helva through stage space. The question left is not what is better or worse, storytelling or story inhabiting, but what kind of language moves one's imagination to new places out of which to speak and write. The answer to this question will always depend on which one you are talking about, and this is where the issue of the politics of form re-enters the discussion. Though it is impossible for feminists to share the same experiences of themselves as political subjects, and therefore the same aesthetics, it is possible to read formal writing practices as political contextual symptoms. The quest to find voice, then, occurs between the covers of each of these books as between two politically and aesthetically different geographical locations. The quest to imagine new embodiments is also a political quest. The boundaries of one's semiotic system, whether that system be verbal, kinesthetic, visual, or other, and the boundaries of anyone's imagination are the same. What is more alien, a fantasy of an altered world or an altered use of the quotidian language of our familiar world? The answer will depend on who and where one is when one asks. In attempting to imagine new voices or to recover lost voices, no one is ever outside of language, though it is quite possible to be at the limits of one's own explored speech. Or, as Fraser says in Another Way Above, it is possible to be structurally out of breath.
My name is Paige Beatty, and I'm the last of four people. And it's interesting, before giving this talk, all week long I've been thinking about how to give this talk, because on the one hand, of course, I've written the paper, and on the other hand, I'm really committed to the idea of talking and of teaching. So I want to try to do both. I've decided, listening to everyone else, I think people have been doing a great job. But a lot of the issues of voice that have been coming up in our papers are also issues about how one reads a paper at a conference and what sort of a voice we use, because of course these papers are one form of our voices, and we have our speaking voices and the way we can communicate with you. And to try to bring them all together, it's of course challenging, but something maybe we'll try to do now. And I'm thinking, well, am I just self-conscious because, you know, I'm in New York and I've seen a lot of Woody Allen films, I don't know. Anyway, I'm starting with a quotation, and that's from the OED, and two different ones, actually. Historians who only take scissors and paste, cut vamp, a book they make. That's Murphy in The Grecian Daughter, among the OED definitions of vamping. To make or produce, buy, or as patching. To adapt, compile, compose, put together. A book composition out of old materials. To serve up something old as new, by addition or alteration. I'd like to look at vamping as writing a self. My larger project, all of us have a larger project for this book, involves a genealogy of the female vampire's body. Okay. Legend tells us that the vampire, having no reflection, is unable to see herself in a mirror. However, it is through a series of projections and representations that we are able to construct the vampire's body. Like the sun, the vampire cannot be looked at directly, but by looking at other projections of the vampire, we will attempt to see her. So my vamping of these vampiric reconstructions, you can follow that, will take the form of a genealogy. But I'm just doing a little bit of a genealogy today. This work is a recognizing of the vampire's line of descent, even as it is a reconnaissance of women's feature. Okay. So you got the definition of vamping. Central to my discussion will be Jodi Scott's Eye Vampire, and everybody has these texts that we hold up to prove to you that they exist, right? Okay, so here it is. Eye Vampire, I'll pass around if people want to touch it. And the other text is Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This is 1984, feminist science fiction, and this you probably, most of you are familiar with, 1928 biography of Woolf's friend, possible lover, Vita Sackville West. In order to locate the place of the female vampires within fictional and historical discourses and practices, it is necessary to outline the vampire's parasitic role on the socio-political body. And I'm just going to say a couple of things about that now. And, okay. I'm going to try to... the vampire simultaneously kills and resurrects its host, which is the body of a socially recognized self. And I mean that in a couple of different ways. For one thing, when the vampire inhabits a body, the person who was that body before it was a vampire is killed, although it resurrects that body because it now is the host. At the same way, in many vampire stories, vampires literally are taken into houses and they kill their hosts, you know. And that's just two of the ways. The vampire self inhabits a body which is neither fully its own nor fully another's. The function of this body is dependent upon the larger community of bodies which supply life and blood. And blood and life are the same thing, of course, for the vampire. The community is a locus of exchange, reciprocity, vitality, and sustenance. Only a real human with a true identity may provide the life stuff for a vampire identity. So, of course, in a world of all vampires would die because, you know, they constantly require human blood. This is such a funny thing to be talking about. But it's an important thing, right? Okay. The vampire exists in exile from the community because it cannot participate in the day-to-day actions that comprise political life. The vampire is resigned to the dark, to the margins of socio-political existence. At the same time, the vampire is drawn to the community and must constantly draw upon the community for the renewal of its life. It's worth noting that suicide is frequently taken to be a precursor to vampirism. And as recently as 1969, this is one of the cases, but this is actually something all through, New England villages, somebody committed suicide, great fear that they would rise up again as a vampire. Renowned vampirologist, he's also a professor at Boston College, but I like to call him a vampirologist, Raymond McNally, on his trip when he's writing his book on In Search of Dracula, tells a story of coming upon a little village where they're having a funeral ceremony, and they're actually a young girl has committed suicide, and they're driving a stake through her heart before burying her because they're afraid she'll rise again as a vampire. The suicide attempts to author itself by enacting the most radical form of opposition upon itself, by embodying as will its negation, by authoring its own death. The community then attempts to seize control over the alienated member by enacting its will upon the suicide's corpse, by the driving the stake through the heart, cutting off of the hands and head, these sorts of things. The contest over what counts as a self, what constitutes a community, the actual relations of power within this community, are evidenced as a literal creation and destruction of bodies and identities. Okay. I'll say some things about suicide, and some of these, I can only really suggest things as everyone can, because these are parts of a much larger discussion. Please seem to clear to you. Okay. Okay, Jodi Scott, author of I, Vampire, begins with a suicide body, that of Virginia Woolf. All right. As a writer of postmodernist feminist science fiction, Scott is vamping the modernist Virginia Woolf as woman's writer, writing a woman writer, and as a woman writer, writing women's writing. Okay. Woolf's Orlando, which Scott, author of this book, just to remind you again, refers to as an early science fiction classic, is helpful to our discussion at this point. Okay. Orlando is both a text, an entity which has a history separate from that of its author, Woolf, and a character, who's the central character of the book, Orlando, who, while sharing a name with the title of the book, sets about to write him and eventually herself. People probably know him. I don't think I'm going to explain a little bit about it. Orlando begins the book as a young boy in Elizabethan England, finest set of legs in Elizabethan England, who goes on to write a manuscript entitled The Oak Tree. This manuscript both embodies and subverts Aristotelian notions of telos. Okay? When Orlando, turns into a woman, okay, which happens towards the middle of the book, for those of you who haven't read it, she sets about rewriting the oak tree, the original manuscript, okay, teleology, filling in the margins and empty spaces left in her early manuscript, literally. This revisioning accompanies the reformation of Orlando's identity as a woman. Her entrance into historical discourse becomes literally embodied in the text which she offers as herself. Is that clear to people? Okay, yes? Okay. All right. Okay. Orlando, the book, is also a biography of Vita Sackville West and stands in this sense as an attempt to enter a woman into historical narrative while actively subverting the straight biographical novel through ironic use of language and form. Even as Woolf remakes and confronts her relationship with Vita Sackville West, Scott, must confront Woolf, the author, Woolf's death. Woolf stands as a figure which authorizes women's writing by bringing it into history, yet her own history is dominated by her authoring of her own death. Scott, writing in 84, wants to rewrite and revive Woolf's form as both an author and a human body. So it is that Jodi Scott creates Sterling Oblivion, the 700-year-old vampire living in 1984 Chicago. Oblivion characterizes herself as a Giotto fresco painted on the side of a Pizza Hut. Okay, quite unlike the traditional figure of the vampire, she works in a normal job as a dance instructor, the Arcady Dance Studio, and she doesn't kill her victims. She's careful to take always less than a cup of blood, 6 ounces. Okay, of her vampirism, she says, and this is from the book, without it, I'd be nothing. A bag of bones in some European crypt. My compulsion is all that sets me above the ruck of women, that scent of conquest, the noble chase, a game of wits, figuring out how I can penetrate and feast without getting my neck broken. I love the lore, history, rich tradition, and fabulous majesty it confers upon an otherwise simple, sentimental, and perhaps boring old woman. Sterling Oblivion meets Virginia Woolf, and this is in the book again, Remember the Vampire, meets Virginia Woolf in the ladies' room of the dance studio where she works. The meeting leads to a fist fight, which turns into dinner and drinks. Oblivion embarks upon a love relationship with Woolf, who turns out to be a space alien, known as a Ricimian sea pig. This is a difficult plot for me to relay, as you see. But I'm just going to give you a sense. You know, this all happens in about 15, 20 pages, right? It goes on with all of these things, like the Sperm of the Month Club, where they go around selling sperm of famous men to women. So you can buy, like, Elvis Presley sperm or, you know, I mean, Pope John Paul sperm. Something like that. And I don't know. I can't even go into it. So I'm giving you a little clue. Okay. Seeing photos of Woolf's sea pig body, that's her space alien body, Oblivion, and remember that's a vampire, is confused as she attempts to establish authenticity. Was Woolf the original, a double? How could I tell? The actual Woolf and the copy are conflated and reconstructed under Oblivion's gaze as she admits that she is warm for her form. And that's Woolf's form. Okay. There's heavy funny going on. I was trying not to. Okay. The other Scott is similarly attracted to Woolf's authority. However, she too must confront the bloated body of Woolf's suicide in order to articulate a self capable of writing and speaking to Woolf, to all the Wolves. Yeah. And in the longer paper, I have a discussion of sort of the five Wolves, and I can't do that. Okay. Woolf's writing is an attempt to subvert teleological thinking. A being's nature will no longer be its function, nor will it be only fully realized in its end. In Orlando, the founding of a non-teleological thinking takes the form of a vamping of teleological writing itself. It is also a vamping of time, a use of the past for the future. Yet Woolf, as author of this future, can have no place in it. In The Wave, she writes, "But I cannot write. I see only figures. I begin to draw a figure, and the world is looped in it, and I myself am outside the loop, which I now join, sew, and seal up, and make entire. The world is entire, and I am outside of it, crying, oh, save me from being blown forever outside the loop of time." Woolf's authoring is bound up with the authoring of her own suicide. Okay, now, again, this is suggestive. This suicide is a speech act, which is something I discuss as suicide and speech act was in my other longer work, which in one reading might be seen as a final punctuation of Woolf's life and writings. If we begin with Woolf's suicide as her talos, we construct a life story which is fully realized only as the author of the death. Scott doesn't want to do this at all, and either do I. Okay, and as I say, actually, we cannot afford to read Woolf this way. All right, as one way that Woolf subverts this ending, Woolf's suicide, is by having a false ending in this book. This book has several false endings. And this false ending, Sterling Oblivion, the vampire, wakes up in the hospital after a suicide attempt. So you find out this vampire, too, besides Woolf, also attempted suicide. She wakes up in the hospital, and she says, wait, you know, it's sort of, you know, Wizard of Oz style. There's no place like home. You know, her name is actually Sterling File. Every character in the book turns out to be somebody who's in the hospital room, doctor, nurse, you know. And she's decided, well, you know, there's what is real is a world of ego, petty politicking, diseased and dying bodies, all very serious and important. And, you know, and she says, so I'm never going to challenge it again. And you think, oh, what a disappointment. I read this book, you know, great, you know. And you turn the page. But anyway, that's what I thought. And there she is, just as that one body is sort of being reeled away to the morgue. Sterling Oblivion wakes up in ancient Egypt with Virginia Woolf once more. So we find that's not actually the end. And again, you know, and also the resignation is not the end. So the vampire image is discarded, along with the Sterling File identity, who's a Sterling File is the one who wakes up in the hospital of the last chapter. As it is transformed, the vampire identity is named for what it was, a series of projections created by socio-political systems out of boredom and frustration. These projections preclude the possibility of constructing a self out of history, outside of a teleology of death. The second ending of I Vampire is a transformation which serves as a bridge to a new kind of narrative, a way of authoring future selves into the past, an authoring of self which is neither fully incumbent upon its teleological foundations nor dependent upon those structures which entomb identities built upon the marginalization and fragmentation of a subject. Okay, what I want to question is the mythos which Norman O'Brown expresses in Love's Body, and quoting him here, the passport which grants access to the public realm, which distinguishes master from slave, The essential political virtue is a courage to die, to commit suicide, to make one's life a living death. Okay, and then that first speech act, which marks entry into the public realm, need not be understood as meaningful only if it kills its speaker. And women's voices must not enter into history by unspeaking themselves. A voice that can only deconstruct itself as it speaks will not allow women to revalue and refuse selves and collectivities. I call this process, or this refusal, and think of all the meanings of refuse in the sense of joining together at the same time that it's taking apart what refusing would be, a vamping. And I see Jody Scott as one voice for this kind of refusal, this kind of vamping. And then we have this kind of, I don't know, I left some sentences on the print on the page, so I'll try to reconstruct it here. This imagining of the female vampire and the female political actress is the voice to which we other Ulysses must now listen. It is a voice which calls us with a certain degree of irony to confront not only those sirens on the rocks, but these images of ourselves as the living dead. So that's, I don't know if I was saying any other things there, but I guess not. But okay, that's about it. So I think what we'd like to do now, if we may, is invite you to join in a discussion.
Thank you.
With all four of us, and we had some ideas, you know, perhaps it is the case that you all have things you'd like to say, which of course would be what we would like to ask first. If not, we have some themes we could kind of bring out for discussion. Again, to emphasize, we're very interested in hearing from people in terms of any sort of a discipline. Clearly, all of us focus in different areas. Susan is in, I guess, poetry and literature. I'm in ethnography. I am primarily in political theory and, I don't know, I guess, cultural criticism. There's a film, literature, fiction, but science, and Lisa, film, semiotics, cultural theory. Which is to say, of course, of our graduate program, that we all try to bring a lot of different disciplines together and to think from those different ways. And also, these are very condensed versions of longer papers. So there might be questions you might have about something which is unclear, which maybe we could answer for you, or you might want to make some suggestions. For the
I just wanted to, you went over again very quickly, but I wanted to.
I think that's good. I think that makes sense. Yeah. Cozy. Okay.
You sort of went very fast. So women's unspeaking, you mentioned resignation. There's a reading you have sort of women's unspeaking, i.e. suicide, resignation, vamping, is not resignation. Is that?
Partially, but also eventually I want to refuse even that. And that the whole idea of, I don't know how much to go into the detail, but the idea of the relationship of suicide to founding and creation, especially of political systems, is something that in my larger work I'm writing about and interested in. So I was sort of alluding to some of those themes. And depending on what people, maybe I can try to talk to you.
If you would like to speak up,
this is supposed to be
check.
It'll take me too long to elaborate. But I think I've had to elaborate on it in three sentences. I don't want to take too long to elaborate on something because I don't want every other person not to have a chance to elaborate. But the idea of how it's possible to constitute the suicide of the speech act is something I'm working on in terms of not only writing a suicide note or writing the text, but also in terms of how that speaking of the self, which I'm interested in the way that it's characterized in a variety of women, all the way from Marilyn Monroe to Lucretia, you know, from the Romans to Antigone to Wolfe. I don't know. I'm afraid to try to go into.
I can ask a specific thing. It sounds more like, I mean, the way you're using it sounds more like it's an inscription. Like it becomes text, which would make it not a speech act. in fact, not confined to temporality, but
that's one of the ways that I am using it. I'm talking about how it is retrospective. Yeah. But I'm also using it in other ways.
But there's a distinction then between the speech act and between the inscription.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Maybe I should have left that about the teachers. It's hard to develop right now. But anyway, do people have general themes in terms of the whole?
I have a general question in terms of the concept or the definition of a feminist science fiction. And I'm sort of thinking of my feet, so forgive me. It's not all together. But, feminist science fiction defined as sort of a vehicle for subverting masculine patriarchal language structures and using them to revision feminist systems, feminist social systems. It's interesting to me in the context of I'm not that familiar with it as a genre, and I wonder, I don't know of any women of color that write science fiction, which struck me as sort of interesting. In turn, one question is, secondly, at least everything that was here discussed, and all of us here, happened to be white, and it seemed as though perhaps it didn't fulfill. Doesn't it perform that function for women of color?
In terms of
the movie Up in Flames, which is Born in Flames, which does try to present and try to embody a multicultural feminist revolution. It embodies it I experienced it as when I saw the movie, it's very positive in its images of a heterogeneity of women's culture. But in the theater, when I saw it, there were women of color who were very critical of the film, very animated by the way women of color were presented in it, which seemed also to, both point to the problems that the movie talks about and also more serious problem that sometimes she didn't manage to succeed, at least for these women, in what she was attempting in the film. So, and it also made me look to tie what Thurza had said earlier to the science fact versus science fiction. And when you're speaking of, I guess, 85% of hysterics of women, are we talking about white women? Because all the women in the ads are white women. And women that are victims or that the recipients of electroshock.
I think certainly it's a really interesting question. What's interesting to me is that women, why I think it is that I think it's what we're using, because Connie Levin is Chicano, and it's very much a book that's about her specific experience of being a non-white woman in an environment where and that for me, the issue of madness is certainly one that is about all human experiences, but certainly as that I think it is as I was using it from the University Archive, the General Archive, it was from the period that the books are written in the mid-70s, so from the mid-60s, and they are all.
Well,
no, it's a sense that this is why we're Yeah, probably the most well-known now would be Octavia Butler. And who writes specifically about the whole racial experience. She writes, slaves, sort of things like slave narrative, all sorts of things. And also Samuel Delaney, who we use again and again, is a black man. It's another person who's working on this project who's not here to give a paper. Precisely one of the things she's writing about is the way that some of the names used in science fiction have masked the true gender and possibly even race of the people writing. And so very often books are being written, Jane's Tiptree is another case, by women under a male pseudonym. And the same, I think, is true. I think that there's probably a growing amount of people of color writing science fiction, but it's not something which we as a group today expressed as much as we might have. I guess it didn't come through in terms of, I don't know, I think it was kind of similar issue.
I just also want to point out, and this came in our discussion amongst ourselves, when Monique Petit's book came out of France, with the more homogeneous culture in terms of, just like, and the issue of race is not picked up, and it's like pointed out, it's more in terms of design in a way, but I don't know if that, and I guess that is pushing towards the difference between women and women, but it almost seems to work on an aesthetic level. But, also, for, say, academics, issues of race and class, perhaps were not foregrounded in certain ways at different historic moments. It's a big issue at the moment. And so it could be in part why, say, in Petit's book, I don't want to denounce her, is not, being able to address these issues, but I do find that problematical. And I just think that at certain moments, people aren't thinking about that. I think white people aren't thinking.
I think what you say is interesting also in terms of this political aesthetic forms that I was talking about. Just in that it, the way that an aesthetics is, the politics of an aesthetic order, I think, it really reflects who is ordering, obviously. And for example, one of the things that brought me to write on what I was writing about is this feeling and experience that I confronted over and over again in academia and elsewhere, that poetry is for white elite women who have a certain position in relationship to dominant language practices, and science fiction is for somebody else, maybe people who don't have that same language position. And I don't think that that is true all the time. I think, though, that it's true that what it means for something to be science fiction for somebody who is not in a more privileged relationship to dominant is a different thing than what it means for someone else. And the same for experimenting with language. And there has not been a lot written about this by women of color that I know of, at least on the experimenting with language. And I'm not familiar with this, but I think that's relevant.
Anyone else have good comments on this?
I'm thinking of in terms of experimentation with language and the structure, particularly with Tony Keith and Morris's novel, and how the self is very central to that.
How the what?
The self, self being fractured, and time being fractured and ordered. And I think that is something that's on the agenda for women of color. I think it's an interesting question to think about the relationship of women of color to science and how it would most definitely be different than what people like women. And, in the same way that we explore difference on a gender level, and how it becomes hyperbolic in science fiction, it would also take different forms, possibly in sections of race and class.
Can you think of other women of color who are doing experimental work with language? Because I always have...
Sure,
yeah.
Not basically.
That's true. I always have trouble besides this.
No, there's an article recently in The Voice criticizing Michelle Walsh was not criticizing The Color Purple with them, and a little more. And she goes into the kind of structural variations within Black literature. And I think I'm familiar with Rob and before I forget the other.
Paul Dunn is
Did you want to say
No, I haven't stopped to think about it.
did is that with electro shock therapy, the ballet start using a black and fluorescent image. So that you get an idea that possibly mental illness isn't defined, but it's a weapon that can be used against them who are they are, who are they are.
Very good point.
Yeah, it's a very shifting category initially, you know, to avoid the classical and primary hysteric category.
Yeah, as they increasingly move into the power.
But hysteria has been defined in the one book as reacting to these historical and social moments in the individuals.
Some other people who haven't had a chance to comment that might like to make.
This is Shipley Trek. We'll get back to that. I guess we can. I have a general comment which turns into a more specific question for Lisa's paper, which is a theme that I could sort of impose on your papers, or I could add to, I'm not sure what it would be about violence, which most relates to the two words that she dealt with. But one aspect of it would be the use of a sort of literal violence. That brings up the vampire, the suicide, Lizzie Borden's murder, but also very much can tie in with questions of insanity. More trouble relating to yours. So violence as revolution, but also the violence of oppression, which I think Wittig is sort of one of the most who's looking at, who's not quite fusing them, but the whole world is violent. So violence sort of on the self, or to the self, and suicide violence to the other. The other would be the quality of violence of action, or particularly violence of words, particularly in the subversive.